Wired Country.
Welcome, everybody. Today, we have a great guest. We got Wabgijik Rice here. He is the author of many amazing fictional books, formerly a CBC full-time journalist and a local guy from Wasauksing First Nation right in the Parry Sound area. Wab, welcome to the show, man.
All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for having me. Really honored to be here with you.
Great. Yeah, thanks for making it. So you were telling me a little bit we're talking about your book, Moon of the Crusted Snow, mm-hmm. which is a bit of sort of apocalyptic, on the edge of apocalyptic. You're telling me a little bit about your upbringing in Wasauksing and what kind of, led you to think about writing this. It was sort of like an outage or?
Yeah. Yeah, well, growing up in Wasauksing was really cool because, you know, I had a pretty firm, I think, bush experience growing up. The house I lived in with my parents and brothers, we didn't have hydro or running water until I was about 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would go out and haul wood and haul water and go to the fish nets with my dad, you know, to bring in the hauls and all that. So it was a pretty embedded, I think, bush experience just growing up. And it's something I've always hung on to, you know, the rest of my life since then, even though I've lived in cities since I was 19, right? But that one moment we were talking about that inspired Moon of the Crusted Snow was what became known as the Northeast Blackout of 2003. Mm-hmm. So in August of 2003, there was this widespread power outage that impacted something like 55 million people in North America. You know, big cities like Toronto, Ottawa, Boston, New York, Cleveland, Detroit, all in the dark, right? And no one knew why. And it was, you know, all this confusion and mystery around it. I was living in Toronto at the time, working as a freelance journalist, but that day it happened, I was back home in Wasauksing with my two younger brothers house-sitting for our dad and stepmom who were away on summer holidays. And it was like a nice sunny summer day, you know, very calm, very hot, and the power just went out all of a sudden, which was kind of weird, right? Because you don't expect that in that sort of placid of
No wind, no storm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we thought, okay, that's weird, but, you know, didn't think too much of it after until, you know, the hours, you know, dragged into the late afternoon and there was still no power. So we got bored, you know, we're a bunch of young guys who, you know, used to playing video games and watching TV.
Idle hands,
exactly, right? So we drove into Parry Sound and we saw the power was out there. And then we saw some friends who had heard on the radio that it was this big blackout. And we immediately thought it was the big one. My brothers and I thought it was the end of the world, right? Mm-hmm. So we went back to the res and, you know, went to our dad's place and, you know, did an inventory of all the food in the cupboards and in the fridge and gathered firewood from the backyard because we're like, this is how we're going to have to cook now because, you know, the electric oven in the kitchen is useless and just made all these plans. And as night fell, you know, we started talking about what we're going to do the next day. And we're like, okay, let's go over and see our uncle. He might have some live bait for us or some tackle we can use to go fishing. And let's go see our auntie over here. You know, if we're not feeling well, she's got some bush medicine for us. And the more we started thinking about that, you know, the more comforted we were. We thought, you know, this is the place to be for the end of the world because we're surrounded by resourceful people, you know, who know how to harvest from the land, make shelter, keep warm, etc., which was essentially our upbringing too. But, you know, my one brother and I who was living in Ottawa at the time, like we'd been removed from that by a couple years, right, by moving away to the city, you know. So I thought, if this is the end of the world, this is the place to be, you know, in the bush on the res.
On Georgian Bay.
On Georgian Bay, exactly.
What a resource that is.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And that's really where the idea formed for Moon of the Crested Snow. And it was many years after that I actually, you know, sat down to start writing it. But I always had that in the back of my head, you know, like if you know, the everything goes to crap and the world ends, you know, why not be in the bush, right?
So there are some, so, you know, Wasauksing and Parry Island is a Anishinaabe Ojibwe indigenous reserve. So for people that are listening that don't realize that, and, you know, it's right in the Parry Sound area, close to Parry Sound, but yet so much wilder, like, you know, you kind of had the best of both worlds living there. The lakes are still loaded. I won't say the name of that big one because fishermen listen to this, but yeah, like, you know what I mean? And you're right on Georgian Bay. And, you know, at least from what a couple of people I know, there is that, there's definitely still people that really know some of the natural plants and medicines, mm-hmm. at least the guys I talk to anyways, yeah. a couple of them, but like to another level mm-hmm. of what most people that are kind of diving into, you know, plants and medicines and stuff like that, just a really, really deeper kind of level yeah. of all kinds of things. And that's pretty interesting. I remember you saying during the time growing up there, so you had this like really cool like bush life, you know, which is what I think a lot of people dream of having, at least romantically, yeah. you know what I mean? And also at a time, you're a young guy like me, right? You know, like
young 70s, ish, early 80s, just young guys. We're so young, yeah.
And around that time, there was sort of like a resurgence in a lot of those kind of traditional mm-hmm. cultures and stuff like mm-hmm. that. Do you think that played out on just your own knowledge, your connection with nature and your upbringing and what you're able to, you know, put into your books? It seems to come from such a natural place, like just what you already explained, mm-hmm. checking on your uncle. Does he have anything? Getting wood. This is all stuff that, it you know, that is very, very much in Moon mm. of the Crusted Snow, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, you know, I feel really fortunate. And of course, it's something you take for granted when mm-hmm. you're young, right? Mm-hmm. As a teen especially, you know, I had a wider sort of vision for my future in the world, which was, you know, to leave the res, to go to the mm-hmm. city, to travel the world, et cetera, et cetera. And I think back in the 80s and 90s, you know, even though I had those great gifts of those teachings growing up, mm-hmm. Maybe they weren't valued as much in the mainstream, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like I think path that was imposed upon me was, oh, go and get your education and mm-hmm. work in this professional career or whatever else. Right. Mm-hmm. But you know, once I was in the city and moved from city to city through adulthood, you know, just having that same connection to my home community was really special, you know, mm-hmm. and it has been really special. And I think when I reflect upon my upbringing and just like, you know, my grandmother asking me to go pick some sumac for a tea, right?
Lemony.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah. It, like somebody was sick, right? And mm-hmm. that's what she did. Or, you know, I remember, you know, there's a medicine you can make with dandelion too, mm-hmm. if you have like some skin conditions like acne mm-hmm. as a teenager, you know, mm-hmm. those are just natural things. You know, my grandma or my aunt would say, go pick me some of this and I'll make something for mm-hmm. this XYZ
so
malady.
So sumac,
right?
has a medicinal, it helps you when you're sick.
Yeah, it has like, yeah. and you know, these are, this is knowledge that has like huge contextual information attached to it too, in mm-hmm. terms of like, you know, a traditional story or, you know, more of a teaching that you'd hear from an elder when you're learning about it. But yeah, mm-hmm. it has like some healing properties for sure, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And those were things that like I would casually pick up as a kid, but, mm-hmm. you know, didn't really appreciate until I was much older, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I talk to people about Moon of the Crusted Snow and Moon of the Turning Leaves, you know, very much the messaging in those stories is to find a way to return to that land-based knowledge. Mm-hmm. And people ask me sometimes, you know, like, oh, how much research did you have to do? Or who did you have to talk to? And I'll be like, well, a lot of it is from my own memory. And mm-hmm. and I feel very fortunate, even sort of privileged to mm-hmm. to have that in my sort of upbringing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And for Moon of the Turning Leaves is the sequel to mm-hmm. Moon of the Crust, which I've just started to get into. Super excited about the direction that's going. But it's an interesting, I guess the word I heard use is like a lens that you can see these things through. So it doesn't take place in Wasauksing. It takes place in another community mm-hmm. that's sort of far northern mm-hmm. Ontario.
Yeah.
So, you know, some kind of differences of of the people's connections maybe to, you know, a larger town mm-hmm. than where you grew up, but still very, a lot of like similarities, I mm-hmm. guess, that you could just kind of, I mean, I guess, write about what you know, they say, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you could just kind of do that.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of the geography, mm-hmm. You know, placing it in far northern Ontario, there's mm-hmm. definitely some research that has to happen there. Because, you know, I grew up on Georgian Bay, you know, not isolated by any stretch of the imagination, right? Mm-hmm. Like a 10-minute drive from Parry Sound, 2.5-hour drive north of Toronto, right. You know.
Still, you're still in the bush, though.
Still in the bush,
right?
Yeah,
like, definitely. I was just up in Whitehorse, Yukon, and these people live, you know, north of 60, right? And they get those winters. But at the end of the day, they got, like, a super center. You know, I was, whenever I would borrow someone's car, I'd be like, oh, my God, they're almost out of gas. Like, how are they going to drive to the... I'm like, oh, yeah, they live in a city, right? So even though it's Whitehorse, Yukon, so it's funny because it was a bit of a juxtaposition, if that's a word, because, you know, I have the guys that are living in a city that everything at their fingertips, but yet they're in this kind of wild northern place and everything around there is wilder, but they were, you're still not living in the bush like you were.
Yeah.
So, you know, I still think that there's, you know, things are close, but then that you're still kind of immersed in a different way that some people might, you know, live in Yellowknife or even some of these northern towns. Mm. You know what I mean? So I think that it definitely played out in your book, which is amazing book, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Really highly recommend anybody watching that. And then one of the things that I think cool that I've done a little bit of research and knowledge, you know, researching is learning a bit of Anishinaabemowin and the language. And there's a lot of that, not a lot, but a fair amount in the book that I thought was pretty interesting. Did you have to make any decisions on whether or not I'm going to write some words in Ojibwe, or how did that come to be?
Yeah, good question. Yeah. I always wanted to have the language in there somehow, you know, just for the sake of representation, to show that the language is still spoken and, you know, it has a future, especially with Moon of the Turning Leaves. I wanted to say, okay, here's a future and our language is still there, right? Mm-hmm. With Moon of the Crested Snow, it was really interesting how that sort of played out in the editorial process. Because, you know, I brought this first draft to the publisher and to the editor. Her name's Susan Renouf. And in the first draft of Moon of the Crested Snow, all of the Anishinaabemowin is spoken in dialogue and then repeated in English by the person speaking it. So the person is essentially translating what they're saying, right? Mm-hmm. So Susan said, you know, that's kind of redundant. Nobody would actually do that. If they're speaking to someone who understands them, they wouldn't repeat the same thing in English, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm still somewhat green in terms of an author. I thought, you know, I thought I would have to do that for the sake of, you know, the readers, right? Mm-hmm. To help guide them through this language. Mm-hmm. And she said, no, there are other ways you can translate it. You know, you can translate it through the context that follows. You can translate it through the action of the moment that the dialogue is in. Or even you could have the other character in dialogue respond in English, and then the reader figures it out that way. So that was really empowering to have her say that to me, you know, a white woman in her 60s from Toronto, you know, when I wasn't expecting that sort of, I guess, acceptance of the language in the manuscript. Mm-hmm. So she said, yeah, be proud of your language. Let it be there. Let it be itself. And you know, I think the readers will be able to discern what different things mean as they read the story. Mm-hmm. And taking that into Moon of the Turning Leaves, I did wanted to take it a step further. And that also is reflective of my own comprehension of the language. Like, I've been trying to constantly improve over the years. And
aren't you about to take a course specifically to learn more of it? Yeah,
I saw
that. That's a recent decision that you've made.
Yeah, I've been accepted into a program called the Anishinaabemowin and Program Development at Georgian College, based in Barrie, but I'll be doing it virtually. And you know, just the time was right for me. I'm very fortunate that these two recent books have done well, and that I am sort of, you know, in charge of my own schedule. And as a freelancer, I can, you know, make time for learning, right? And I have time to, you know, incorporate this full-time learning schedule into my writing and work schedule, I guess. So
that's a dream, man.
Oh man, I'm so lucky to be able to do that. Yeah. And you know, being a dad to three kids, you know, I feel like it's my responsibility to work hard at passing the language on to them.
Yeah, I can relate to so many of the things we're talking about, but sometimes from a bit of a different perspective. It's, you know, when you're following your passion like you're doing, it's definitely not less work, but it doesn't always feel like work because you love doing it so much. If you were really to tally up your hours and show people what your hourly wage would be, or would they be like, oh my God, stay out of that business. But for you, for us, it doesn't feel like that.
No,
it feels
you're right.
Freaking amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah. It is a privilege for sure. Yeah. Even like making a social media post late at night after the kids are in bed, that's still quote unquote work, right? Yeah. But I mean, it's something enjoyable too, because you're passionate about it, as you can fully relate with, you know?
Absolutely. I think one of the things that really has gripped me is, you know, basic interest interested in learning more about, you know, the Ojibwe language, I think has to do with, I think people think like, oh, I got to learn a language. I'm learning this whole way of talking, but you just learn little pieces. And all of a sudden you're looking at things. You see a different way, a different mindset of perceiving something, whether just like the animate and inanimate objects, what they see, the Anishinaabe Mohan language talks about as live and what is, and like that, just that way of thinking, that's fascinating. And for a guy like me, and for anybody here on that's watching my YouTube channel or my podcast that are into the outdoors, which we both have a background in, I think one of the most interesting things about it, especially if you're going out onto the land into an area like this, is that so much of this language was formed, you know, for ancient through thousands of years here. So, for example, in English, you have to learn what the name of a tree is. Mm-hmm. Then you have to learn what it's good for. Mm-hmm. Right. Or you might have to learn what the name of a lake is and then what kind of fish are in there. But Anishinaabe Mohan, it just talks about, it just tells you all at once.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. You have the word and the, like, I don't want to be wrong, but I think the word for hickory is good bow wood or something.
Is
like
it?
That.
Yeah.
It translates. Yeah. I might be wrong about that, but I think that's one of the things that really interested in me.
Yeah.
In learning about it more. Is that accurate to you?
Oh, does that's totally accurate. You know, there's so much you can learn just from what something is called. Right. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, view of the objects in the world around us, whether they're animate or inanimate, you know, totally informs the rest of the grammar, right? Which is totally mind-blowing, because things totally change. Like, words change depending on whether an object is animate or inanimate. And it's a very verb-based language too, right? Like, the verb is like the sort of central piece of like the sentence or the narrative structure or whatever else. And it builds outwards from, you know, the prefixes and the suffixes, you know, not to get too technical linguistically. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of a totally different way of looking at language. And I'm glad you brought up place names, because, you know, like in I guess a modern sort of Western context, so many things are named after people. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, the place names in Anishinaabe Mohan or Ojibwe would be very descriptive. Like Wasoxing, for example. Mm-hmm. There's still debate over how to directly translate that, but it generally refers to like something that reflects, right? Or something that's shiny, and it could be like the birch trees that are close to the water, or it could be like the rocks that are on the shoreline or whatever else, right? But that's what people know Wasoxing as, is that place that reflects something, you know. And yeah, you see examples of that throughout the land, and you know, fortunately, like here in Ontario, a lot of places still have those original place names, right?
Well, Amick Lake,
yeah,
beaver. Wawash Kesh,
yeah, deer.
And then it's debatable what the Magnetawan River, because you know, you'll hear it called Na Magnetawan River, Na Magnet, and then it was shortened. Uh-huh. So there's different ideas of what it means, but I've heard swiftly flowing river before. I've heard the Na could refer to sturgeon once being at the mouth.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Because I think Na
is sturgeon.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. Na Me. Yeah.
That's cool.
That makes sense. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, and then sometimes what I don't understand is you can hear how one of these words sometimes has two meanings.
Yeah.
How can one name have two meanings in the language?
I guess it depends on the interpretation and the dialect. But like if you take my name, for example, Wabagijik, if you translate that directly, it means white sky. Mm-hmm. You know, Wab or Wabshka means white, and Gijik means sky. Mm-hmm. Gijik also means cedar. So it depends on the context too.
Okay,
But that word Wabagijik also refers to the color of the sky at dawn. So, you know, before the sun comes over the horizon, sometimes there's like a neutral color in the horizon, depending on where you are, right? But that's what that word refers to, too.
I notice Wab used a lot, and my guess, like, so Wabamik, you probably drove by White Beaver,
yeah.
Yeah, and my friend of mine, I noticed, by the way, you have a pretty awesome knowledge of kind of the history of this area too. But a friend of mine said, is that because all the white people showed up and cut down all the trees like a beaver? And my guess is that white has some sort of connotation, like, you know, like an albino yeah. would be a white beaver mm-hmm. would be like how many people get to see a white beaver mm-hmm. in their entire life. So obviously there's some good medicine or something
yeah.
interesting about it that holds some sort of power.
Yeah. Like maybe centuries mm-hmm. or thousands mm-hmm. of years ago, somebody saw a white beaver there and it was, and I don't know, I'm mm-hmm. only speculating now, mm-hmm. but that's sort of how those names come about too. You know?
Right. So. Right. Yeah.
And now a little bit from one of our sponsors, Fishing Clash. Fishing Clash is an exciting video game that you can play on your phone. Just download it from the App Store or from Google Play. Fishing Clash has a partnership with Major League Fishing, where you can actually go to some of the Major League Fishing tournament events, and there you can get points and rise in the ranks between other Fishing Clash players. Check out the YouTube video version of this episode of Baird Country, where you'll find a link in the description, and you can redeem a special gift with a $20 value by using gift code Baird. BAIRD. This game is a lot of fun. Check it out.
I don't want to give away too much of your book, but we're going to have to give away
yeah, a little bit. It's all good.
Yeah.
All good.
Yeah. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting about Moon of the Crusted Snow was that there's a lot of premonitions in there. Right. So dreams people are having sort of end up, so, and they're pretty dark. To be honest with you, the book was like, there was one point when I was reading it, when, you know, the bad guy mm-hmm. came up, Justin Scott. Yeah. And I was just like, I got to pause my reading here for just a bit because yeah. I'm just like too angry. But overall, it was just like a very exciting, like, you know, like a little bit of a thriller aspect to it. Right. But what I thought was interesting is the premonitions were sort of like almost like foreshadowing yeah. was people's dreams that they would have, that they had. Right. Mm-hmm. And they'd share, I saw this, I saw this. And that essentially in the book became kind of true. But I mean, what I think amazed most people about that book is that you wrote that book pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so in the book, you're talking about people that have sort of premonitions of what's come to be, but your entire book was a premonition of what the, you know, the a lot of similarities, mm-hmm. fortunately, how can I say this without giving away? Maybe we'll just say maybe it turned out better, the COVID pandemic.
Yeah.
But, you know, is that just a total fluke? Or did you actually have some sort of, you know, a guess or understanding of the COVID pandemic coming?
Oh, no crystal ball in my closet or anything like that. But, it was definitely weird timing because the book came out in the fall of 2018 mm-hmm. and only a year and a half after that was the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. When I was, looking at, you know, my version of an end of the world, I really like just tapped into, because I worked in the news for so long, right? Mm-hmm. And every so often a big crisis comes up or a big natural disaster and the same things happen almost all the time. You know, mm-hmm. people will like totally empty the store shelves. Mm-hmm. They'll hunker down. They'll become paranoid about everybody else. Mm-hmm. They'll try to flee elsewhere and so on, right? So there's this pattern that humans have fallen into. And when I was writing about that in Moon of the Crescent Snow, I wanted to show it on a much smaller scale, right? This very small reserve in Northern Ontario, how the same things happen because we're just so, I think, tapped into, you know, the everyday ongoings and I think the fragility of the world around mm-hmm. us. Like, we're constantly reminded of that by, you know, mainstream media or by popular culture or whatever mm-hmm. else. But that's like such a narrow view of the world, you know? Like, when we come somewhere like here, we're reminded that, you know, this vast mm-hmm. landscape around us is really mm-hmm. what sustains us, right? Mm-hmm. And if we can detach from like that narrow view of like what we actually need, mm-hmm. Of what, you know, I guess we're, I think, purported to need by the mainstream, then I think we can sort of maybe more easily I think, accept like who we are as humans and, and what our capabilities are in the natural world around us and our ability to form community, right? So I think like it was a reaction to that, you know, just seeing that play out so often. And then when the like actual pandemic happened and then people were like buying all the flour off the store shelves.
All the toilet paper,
all the ground beef. I was like, oh man, it was eerie at the same time because it was like, it was the only thing that was happening, right, in the whole entire world. So I thought, okay, you know, I didn't think I like jinxed us all by like writing about that, but at the same time, I was like, oh, this is so weird to see, but you know, like, what I tried to sort of, I think, focus on myself for my own mental health was like, in those early months of the pandemic, there were some really cool discussions happening, you know, about small-scale agriculture or community gardens or figuring out better ways to feed ourselves in our communities because, you know, the trucks and the trains couldn't come into the towns and cities anymore, right, to stock the grocery stores and all that. So that was, like, kind of heartwarming to see those things happen. Of course, they didn't last, but at the same time, I think we were able to at least be cognizant of that potential anyways, you know?
Yes. Yeah. And if there's any, and you probably know this from, you know, from your sort of land-based upbringing and relying to an extent on fish and, you know, stuff that you can harvest. I don't know if you ever did any growing a vegetable. I have a three sisters garden, by the way.
Oh, nice.
It's not super huge, but I love
it's there,
it. You know? Yeah, it's pretty, you know, yeah. I'm getting better at it. But one of the things that I learned is when I was on the show alone was just how much we take for granted how much food we eat every day and how much work it is to actually get that food.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know, because it's like fasting, just how you get a clear mindset, just like, what do they call it? Like a vision quest or something? Like Ojibwe vision quest. You don't eat for like 3 days,
fast,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you fast and you get clearer. So I sort of was feeling that a little bit when I was on the show alone. And I think that's one thing, like absolutely. And I kind of realized the infrastructure, getting foods to the grocery store, how much food I actually need to eat and how much time it takes to get that food. And then how little time I actually have to do other things like that are going to potentially better my situation.
Yeah.
I remember watching a previous season and it took this guy 3 weeks to build a boat. And me being an armchair quarterback, I'm like, well, I'm just going to go in there and build a boat like way faster. Well, it took me 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Right. And like literally the exact same period of time.
Yeah.
And I think probably that's something that a lot of people kind of don't or take for granted or are used to just being able to get food so easily that they forget. I also see, you also hear some sentiment also with, you know, non-Indigenous people sometimes thinking, oh, you know, the Indigenous people, they're taking too much, they're hunting, they're over-harvesting. Yeah. But I think that's a reflection of just them being not aware of how much food they eat themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was kind of something that was brought to light a little bit in Moon of the Crusted Snow, even though they had like a storage of food, you know, that was started getting dwindling. And, you know, we all know where that kind of went with the book. I don't know if you could speak on any of that. Not really a question, but.
Well, you know, that sort of scarcity, I guess, idea is something that's so ingrained in all of us. Right.
Right.
And, you know, we've been so hyper individualized just as a society that we don't think about those community connections. I include myself in that too, you know, having lived in cities for, you know, the second half of my life, you know, but what I think food can teach us is that community building sort of notion of really supporting as many people as possible and how many people it takes to create food or to grow food or to harvest food, right? The more people you have coming together to do that, the more you'll yield and the healthier your wider community is, right? No matter how many people are in the fold there. So in Moon of the Crescent Snow, they have to sort of, a lot of them have to sort of relearn that because it's a community in transition, right? It's in far northern Ontario, but at the same time, they've been connected to this new hydro grid. There's a new service road that connects them to the south that isn't operational year-round, but at the same time, it's a new link, right? And you know, they become reliant upon communications technologies like satellite TVs, cell phones, and all that. So that's sort of detaching them from the land or from that sort of human, I guess, practice of harvesting, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I talk about both of these books, you know, that sort of love letter to the land always comes up, and that messaging of, you know, reconnecting with it and so on. And people always ask me about that from in an Indigenous context, but I always remind everybody that it's not strictly an Indigenous context at all, you know? Mm-hmm. Around the world, every culture, civilization, society, whatever you want to call it, comes mm-hmm. from an agrarian background. Mm-hmm. And we've all only been, I think, reliant upon technology mm-hmm. and industry for the last, you know, 2 or 3 centuries, right? Mm-hmm. So in the book, it's hoping to remind people of our connection that we all have with it. That we all have with nature, yes. Yeah. And how nature can sustain us all. Mm-hmm. And we've all had those gifts. We've all had those connections around the world, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very small snapshot in Moon of the Crested Snow, but that's mm-hmm. what you see, you know, as the power goes out and, you know, they're cut off from the world to the south. You know, it takes, you know, a few people to bring everybody else on board. And you know, they start to get there, but at the same time, they take some steps back too because of these other influences that are in the community and so mm-hmm, on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
and people that have just kind of become detached yeah. from that as well. Mm-hmm. And some people are sort of still have those skills and some people don't mm-hmm. and people are trying to learn. How important do you think, you know, understanding being connected with nature is, and conserving it as well, conserving some of the wild places? That's something that's important to you?
Oh yeah, it's important mm-hmm. to me. And you know, I don't necessarily engage in that way of life as often as I should, mm-hmm. you know, living in a city now and mm-hmm. you know, raising kids in an urban setting. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, we still have a place in Wasoxing that nice. We spend, you know, a lot of our time in the summer at. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool just to get our kids there, because when they're in the bush, you know, on mm-hmm. the res, they don't want their tablets. They don't want to turn on the TV. Mm-hmm. They don't ask about the Nintendo mm-hmm. Switch or anything like yeah. that, right? So yeah.
My kid too, man, when he's here, he's like freaking out because he wants to watch like Paw Patrol yeah. or whatever. By the way, there's so many gaps. As a writer, you might notice that, be like, yeah. how are these puppies, where are the real police?
Exactly.
Like yeah. we should do one of those videos, like parents react yeah, videos exactly. or something. Anyways, yeah, and he's like freaking out about this, wanting to watch this, but yeah, when we're in the bush, doesn't even come up.
Yeah.
You know, there's just other things drawing his attention that are way more interesting yeah. left and right and all that. Mm-hmm. And you could just see how good it is for them.
Yeah, like all their learning. Our middle guy, mm-hmm. you know, he's just turning 4 this year, but he loves going back because mm-hmm. he loves picking berries. You know, nice. He can walk through the bush and find raspberries mm-hmm. or blueberries. Of course.
He's 5?
He's almost 4. Almost so this 4. Was wow. when he was 3. Okay. Yeah. yeah. Of course, we have to supervise because right. you can't eat every berry in the right. bush. You know?
Right, right. Well, the ones you can't eat don't taste very good.
Exactly. But you know, seeing him engage yeah. in that way is just so cool. It's like, yeah. but you know, that's what we all have in us.
Yeah.
We just need that access to the natural world, you know?
Yeah. Cause I know a lot of parents are maybe scared of letting their kids eat. Maybe they're scared of eating berries. Is there anything you could say to other parents that maybe want to get into the outdoors a bit that would, you know, make them feel more comfortable, you know, letting their kids sort of browse? I mean, I do it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I have my answer, but is there anything that you would say would be helpful for a parent that wants to kind of take another step and not be so afraid?
Yeah, well, I think just being out there, yeah. Getting yourself into the bush, you know, obviously being cautious and, you know, having some guidance, you know, is crucial. You can't just go out into the bush and do it.
Just start eating everything.
You can't just go start eating everything, right? Like, yeah. I had parents who taught me, like, yeah. you know, my dad who's Anishinaabe and my mom who's Canadian, like, she raised us in the bush too, right, with my dad. You know, so we had those people telling us what we could and couldn't eat, and that's what I share with my kids, right? But if you don't have that, you don't really have to go far to find it. You know, there's the internet that you can find people guiding just you on YouTube.
Essentially, educate yourself.
Educate yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. Educate yourself. And then, you know, the more knowledge we know, the less fear-based choices we make.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And it's funny too, like my one brother and I talked about this recently, you know, like a lot of people are scared of the bush at night, you know? Mm-hmm. They don't want to go camping because they're worried about dangers in the deep, dark bush. Right. But there's not really anything there that can hurt you. Like maybe a mama bear in this area, like, but that's rare.
Very rare.
Very rare.
I mean, has there ever even been anybody reported attack or killed by a bear there in this, maybe Algonquin.
Yeah, not that I know of where right. I'm from, you yeah. know, ever, yeah. right?
Right.
So, yeah, I think, mm-hmm. yeah, there's some sort of barrier there that people have of fear. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, I don't know what it takes to get past it beyond just being there in the mm-hmm. first place, you know, mm-hmm. and appreciating it and respecting it and just, you know, admiring it at the same time and growing to love it like we all do.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is a Wendigo?
Good question.
I figured we were talking about things that could scare yeah, you yeah, in the bush. Yeah. I wanted to ask you that because again, without giving any spoilers, it doesn't directly say it in uh-huh. your book, but we do learn in Moon of the Crusted Snow what a Wendigo mm-hmm. is
yeah.
in a very real sense of the word.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because it really ties into a lot of the things we're talking about in terms mm-hmm. of like understanding our place on the land and mm-hmm. what we need to do to sustain ourselves and so on. So a Wendigo is a figure in Anishinaabe and Meshkego Cree cultures. Mm-hmm. You know,
Wendigo.
Yeah.
In it, Cree.
Yeah, yeah. exactly. Yeah. yeah. Here in Northern Ontario mm-hmm. and a bit beyond. It's a creature that, you know, can come into a community and exploit it and manipulate it, you know, mm-hmm. in times of weakness, right? And, mm-hmm. you know, it turns people against each other. And its main, I think, objective is to multiply itself. Mm-hmm. And I'm only talking from, like, the stories that I know from my reference, right? Mm-hmm. From our Anishinaabe mm-hmm. perspective. And one thing that fuels it is cannibalism. And when I was a kid, the stories we would hear about the Wendigo were primarily to deter us from cannibalizing each other, right?
Right.
Which was never right. really a risk, but
probably
at the same
a good lesson.
Yeah, it's a good lesson that. Anyway, yeah. right?
Don't eat each other.
So yeah. we would hear from like our grandma or mm. our aunties, you know, never eat human flesh or else you're going to turn into a Wendigo. That was the basic messaging, you know? Mm. And of course, if you go back like generations and generations, you know, that was, you know, something that people had to actually consider.
Yes.
You know, in times yes. of despair and hunger and so on. Right, right,
and like stop, like, you know, and essentially people through times, yeah, starvation,
yeah,
would really need that lesson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
you know, because it might, you know, what if people start doing that? Well, mm-hmm. you're going to be the community is going to fall apart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, that's the message. You know, don't eat other people, or else you're going to turn into a Wendigo. Mm-hmm. I, you know, hadn't fully intended to go down that route with Moon mm-hmm. of the Crested Snow until, you know, deep into writing of the first draft. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this antagonist, Justin Scott, that she mentioned, who comes into the community after the blackout, and he, you know, imposes his will upon the people. He mm-hmm. sort of puts up this facade of being a, you know, of assistance,
nice guy.
A nice guy. Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, as we get to know him, you know, he has nefarious intentions, right?
Just such a douchebag.
just a douchebag, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I always had the whole story mapped out, you know, mm-hmm. his outcome predetermined, et cetera, without giving too much away. Mm-hmm. But it comes to this point in the story, and this won't spoil it too much for anybody who hasn't read it, but Evan, the main character, has mm-hmm. this dream about a Wendigo-like figure, and it turns out to be Justin Scott, right? Mm-hmm. And when I was writing that, you know, or when I was dreaming it up, it was always going to be Evan dreams of this monster that turns out to be Justin Scott. But when I actually wrote it down, I was like, holy geez, I wrote it out like a Wendigo, which I didn't originally intend. So I was talking to my dad shortly after, and he's great in terms of a cultural reference for me. Like, I always inquire with him, you know, in any cultural elements about what I'm writing. I ask him if it's appropriate or if it's accurate or whatever mm-hmm. else, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, Dad, you know, I this bad guy in the story, you know, he turned into a Wendigo, and I didn't even like mm-hmm. anticipate that. Mm-hmm. He's like, well, of course it did. And it's totally natural because you grew up with those stories mm-hmm. and, you know, whether you realized it or not, that character was always the Wendigo, mm-hmm. When you're dreaming it up and writing it. And now he's emerged as such, you know, he's shown mm-hmm. his true character to you as the Wendigo, as you're writing it. And it was totally mind blowing just to think about how those stories that I heard as a kid were just so embedded in mm-hmm. there that they emerged in different ways, you know? So yeah. So that's the sort of emergence of the Wendigo in part one for sure. But like my whole intention behind including Justin Scott was for him to be an allegory for all kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. Like colonialism, capitalism, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And the Wendigo could be an allegory for that too, more generally at the same time in a modern context, right? So seeing those things emerge was pretty cool for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And when I read this, I thought to myself, this would be a great movie. You know, you could have indigenous cast. Mm-hmm. You could get me to play Justin Scott. Just throwing that out you know, I'd have to shave my head.
Oh man, you're a big guy, so yeah.
I got a couple scars, maybe pull it off. But is there any thought, or is that something that you would consider doing?
Oh, I'd love to see it. You know, there had been an option pursued. It was picked up. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. The pandemic was a big factor behind that. But now that Moon of the Turning Leaves is out, hopefully, you know, with both stories out there, something can happen in terms of an adaptation. And I'd love to see it, you know.
It's almost like both of those together would be really cool. It'd be cool, but then how it's like you need two movies.
Yeah.
Really. You need two movies.
Yeah, for sure. Know? Yeah. Or else, you know, two season series or something like that.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. So. Can you give a little bit of a look into a Moon of the Turning Leaves and just give kind of like an oversight of what that book's about.
For sure. Yeah. Mm. And this won't give too much away about Moon of the Crested Snow. But at the end of Moon of the Crested Snow, they've sort of moved on into a new setting, a new settlement that they've created. Moon of the Turning Leaves finds them in the same new settlements 10 years later. So 12 years after the blackout, because the epilogue in Moon of the Crested Snow is 2 years after the blackout, right? Mm-hmm. So many of the same characters are still there. The community is much smaller because, you know, in the aftermath of the blackout, a lot of people have died. And they've sort of returned to their land-based ways, right? They're hunting, they're fishing, they're gathering medicine and food from the bush. But they've been in the same place for so long that they recognize a lot of the resources around them are starting to dwindle. And a lot of the tools that they brought with them are starting to fall apart and deteriorate too, right? So they have this revelation that, you know, traditionally, historically, the Anishinaabeg that they're descended from would have been migratory. You know, they would have moved from place to place according to season, according to food supply. And they realize, you know, they've been in one place for too long. They're starting to deplete the land around them, and they need to move on to allow it to replenish itself. And then there's the whole other element of them being isolated since the blackout. You know, they've done a few attempts at exploratory missions that have failed in the 10 years since moving to this new place, but they realize they haven't done a wholesale trip to the south to see, you know, what's happened. If in fact the world has ended, they don't know that for sure, right?
Oh, so that's so somebody's going to go try to get news.
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, so, cool. So they decide it's time to move on. And also it's explained in the first book that they've been displaced from the Great Lakes to far Northern Ontario.
Right.
So they think, well, if we're going to go south, we may as well see if we can return to our original homeland.
Yes.
So they strike an expedition of six people, including Evan and Nungos, his daughter, and a few other people. And the whole story is essentially them going south over the course of a summer and rediscovering the land, but also making discoveries about this new world.
How do they travel?
By foot. Parts of these failed exploratory missions were by canoe, by boat. But there is another added, it's not as explicit, but one added sort of point of tension is climate change in the second book. You know, they can't predict the rivers as much as they've been able to before.
Right.
So they decide to bail out on taking the river south altogether. Yeah. So
we can see that here with just such a low snowfall this year, and then we have like flood conditions in like early March. Just such a bizarre.
Yeah, that river's running pretty fast right now.
Well,
right?
It's actually gone down because we had a big melt in like late February. It's like 12 degrees and they're just like, what is going on around here? It's so crazy. Yeah.
So anyway, they go on this mission, walk through the bush for about a month and a half, and make some wild and wacky discoveries.
Cool. Nice. Love it. Could you, yeah, I mean, what a thing we all take for granted. I remember reading how, you know, they're using a fishnet, a gill net, which is, by the way, indigenous North American invention, I understand. Mm-hmm. Like the rest of the world uses them now, but they're originally invented here. And you just think, imagine having to make one of those.
Yeah.
Like out of like nettle or something.
Yeah.
And even just the skill. I don't know if you've ever, you know, you what do? You twist away from yourself and fold it back. So you have a you know, three strands.
Yeah.
You twist it away and then fold it back. Then they twist the next one away and fold it over. Twist the next one away and you just keep going. Then you have to know how to you make one shorter than the other, so then you can attach different pieces together make them like thinner than a bowstring.
Yeah.
Like imagine how much work that would be.
Like just thousands of times, essentially. Right.
Yeah. Or just I'm just finding the materials. Yeah. I think that's something that people take for granted too. Is just, you know, you just, if you're trying to make something like this in our modern world, we just sit there with the materials. Like, you know, we take the inner strands of parachute cord out and make a net, which is effective. Imagine having to find all of that material and then do it. And it just kind of where I see it going is how, you know, how important that sort of magnified is, how important a community is for kind of long-term, you know, survival, if you will, or just living sort of in a natural way, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember being on a loan, being like cast out there in the fall and just kind of realizing and learning, you know, from indigenous people of that area. I was on Northern Vancouver Island. At that time, they were feasting and gambling in their plank houses, like doing a lot better than us, after capitalizing off seasonal abundances, right? Yeah. And, you know, then I learned how they would actually, you know, sort of cast away some of the younger kids in similar situations just so they could learn how important their tribe is. Mm. And I'm just thinking, I got that lesson.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, and, you know, we all think that, you know, Rambo, you see Rambo, he could survive out there, or, you know, some, you know, and so probably somebody could.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, there's only so many calories in a given location. Yeah. So it doesn't matter how good of a survivalist you are, you're not going to manifest calories there.
No.
And if you're weakened by the walls of your own hunger, it's very hard to travel at that point.
Yeah.
So I feel like that, you know, they were smart enough in, you know, Moon of the Turning Leaves to sort of get ahead of that ball and, hey, let's move, let's do something before our resources completely dwindle. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know,
well, it's you know, and that gets back to what we've been talking about is just, you know, understanding and acknowledging everything that the land can provide you and your proximity, you know, and just how that knowledge is just so crucial.
Yeah.
You know? And people who are working to bring it back are doing amazing things in terms of raising that awareness. Right?
Yeah. So. Did you have to do any research into you know, traditional skills, into you know, survival, things like that, you know, what we call survival nowadays? I don't think what indigenous people did in this area 500 years ago would be considered survival, you know what I mean, unless everything went horribly wrong. But did you have to brush up on some of that kind of stuff?
A little bit, you know. What happens in the second one is Nungos becomes like one of the lead hunters, and she's an archer. So, you know, I've never, you know, bagged anything with a bow and arrow. So I had to do a bit of research around just how that works and all that. Right. But the thing is, like, when you're writing a story that needs to go at a certain pace, you can't get too bogged down in the details, but you do have to know those things. Yourself anyway. And Hemingway called it like the tip of the iceberg, right? Like you're only showing like the more interesting or active bits.
You're not writing a how-to survival skills book. You're trying to tell a story.
But you still need to know that stuff too, right? Because, you know, you can it's going to fall apart if there's not that foundational research there, you know? Mm-hmm. So there was some of that survivalist research, some geography, you know, climate research that I had to do. Mm-hmm. Really just considering what it takes to walk through the bush mm-hmm. for that long.
Yeah.
You know, the supplies you would need, mm-hmm. how you would create shelter, how you would hunt and fish while on the go like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there was a lot of that, you know, I had to look into.
It's hard to travel and kind of get food, right?
Yeah.
It's one thing to set up, get a bunch of food, preserve it, and then travel and get like bits and pieces as you go. But to travel, and which is, I think, one of the most impressive things about stories I've heard is, you know, people leaving and, well, we're running out of food about here, so here's where we'll get a moose and preserve it. Like, just having that confidence is just crazy good.
There's a moment in Moon of the Turning Leaves where they set like a day and a half aside so that they can smoke some deer meat like on the shore of this lake. Just because they need to like refuel at that point, right?
So, like that's one of the impressive things about, because nowadays when we go out, like when I go on a camping trip, I'm trying more and more to bring food that I've harvested and grown and stuff like that with me. But a lot of the time, you know, you're going to the grocery store and you're bringing everything. And if you run out of that food, you're just going to starve out there, right? So the ability to just go out there and just have the confidence to just live like that as you're traveling is like a fortunately seems to be kind of a dying a skill in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, and like full transparency, even though I researched and wrote about it, like I would be in rough shape too if it was up to me to walk through the bush for a month and a half. Yeah. I wouldn't last, you know?
So. Or you'd be like in amazing shape at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that brings me to, I noticed that you do Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you just got your black belt?
I did, in December.
Yeah, that's cool. Actually, it's crazy the way that you came onto my radar. I forget what it was, but I was following you on Instagram. Well, it turns out my buddy, Ryan Fleming, who teaches Ojibwe or did teach Ojibwe in Parry Sound, actually taught your brother. And I was starting the podcast and he's like, you got to get this guy and you try Wob. And, you know, then another friend in the Yukon lent me your book.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, oh my God, I got a freaking talk to this guy. Sweet. You know what I mean? You know, amazing. But anyways, I just found it pretty interesting that, you know, you have this, you know, we call it like a traditional like childhood. You've gone on to be work for the CBC. You've gone on to be now a professional full-time author, which is just a dream that so many people aspire to be, but also could just like, you know, kick some ass. You know? You know, what was it about martial arts and, jiu-jitsu that interested you?
Oh, you know, it was, I think it was boredom, you know? I played organized sports all through, you know, my childhood and teen years. Like, wasn't good, was mediocre at best. But by the time I, you know, got past university and was, you know, in my 20s, all I would do is just, like, either run or lift weights, right? Mm-hmm. Which I enjoyed, but by the time I got to, like, 29, 30, I was like, is this all there is? You know, like, I'm going to be running and lifting weights for the rest of my life, and I'm getting kind of bored. Fortunately, it was Wob Canoe, the premier of Manitoba, who introduced me to Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
So no kidding.
I was living in Winnipeg working for CBC, and he was too, and we became friends. And he and another buddy of ours named Gabriel Daniels had just started it like maybe a few months or a year before. And they said, yeah, come and try it out. You know, I've always been interested in martial arts. My dad's a third degree black belt in karate. And he's a wrestler too, former All-Ontario. So he has a martial arts background. And, you know, I was into it a bit as a kid, but just didn't stick with it because of all the other sports I was doing, right? But yeah, by the time, you know, I was 30, I think 30 or 31, you know, Wob said, yeah, come to the gym and try it out. And I loved it immediately. It was like, it was just so fun. It was so hard.
I feel like you actually get to fight in jiu-jitsu because in the karate, like you're not actually going to punch everyone in the face. You know what I mean?
No.
So when jiu-jitsu, right? Because when you're sparring it, you can never really be real. But jiu-jitsu, if you're just using jiu-jitsu moves, you actually get to roll and to try some of the moves.
Yeah, You get to, you know, manipulate limbs. You get to put on choke holds. And it ends in a tap often. And you know, know, that's quote unquote a victory, I guess,
right,
you know?
Right.
But yeah, it is. It is that live rolling, yeah, which is like so therapeutic, man. Like, yeah, you know, if you're able to like, you know, I guess engage in this, you know, very physical activity, mm-hmm, with very specific goals. You have a training partner who's pushing you too. It all is just such a release, you know? Mm-hmm. That's what I've loved.
The exercise of it?
Yeah, the exercise, yeah, of it, the whole mental element too, yeah, because you have to plan all your moves. You have to prepare for all different kinds of scenarios. And yeah, I just got so much out of it from the beginning.
So much thinking.
Okay, so much thinking.
He's doing this. I have to counter with this, then this, and this, but all in a split second.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
if he thinks about something better first, you're like, uh-oh, then you have to rethink what you're going to do.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And it's like, you know, colloquially known as like human chess because of like, mm-hmm, all those sequences you have to plan out while somebody's like crushing their shoulder in your face or while they're mounting you and your solar, yeah, plexus are being crushed, you know, yeah, so... So yeah, there's a lot of pressure there, and
that's cool.
Yeah, I just love it. It's great.
That's really cool. Yeah, I had to. I definitely want to hear a bit about that. So let's go back a little bit. I think one of the things that I'm interested in is sort of why you decided that, or what was it that was making you think I gotta get into writing. I got fiction. I got to get into creative writing. Was there anything specifically or a point in your life where you're like, I have to find a way to do this, mm-hmm, hopefully for my career?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was reading Indigenous authors as a teen. Mm-hmm. You know, when I
Joseph Boyden?
Not, you know, more.
I'm sort of half kidding.
Did you notice my very diplomatic sort of reaction?
I did.
That's funny. Yeah, right. Yeah. Well played, sir. Well, right, played. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, starting high school, like, mm-hmm, you know, I really liked the English class. I liked reading novels. I liked the creative writing assignments. But back, mm-hmm, in the 90s then, you know, Indigenous authors were not on the radar at all in terms of the, mm, curriculum. You know, wasn't exposed to them through any sort of class or teachers. Mm-hmm. But I had this aunt who was one of my teachers on the school on the res, who always, you know, checked in on me and my peers about how school was going. And, you know, one time she was asking me about high school and I said, oh yeah, English class is my favorite. You know, she said, what do you like about it? And I said, oh, I just like reading. You know, I like doing the creative writing. And she asked me, you know, who are you reading? What authors? And I was like, oh, you know, like Shakespeare and W.O. Mitchell and J.D. Salinger and like, mm-hmm, all white dudes, right? Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm, my aunt just kind of went, oh, yeah, you know, interesting. And then afterwards, funny, yeah. And afterwards she started giving me, yeah, books by Indigenous authors. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point where I was like, oh, you know, I've made this connection with the English language in this way. You know, I really enjoy expressing myself through it, but I've never made that connection about it being a viable form of expression for me because I'd never seen Indigenous authors. Right. Mm-hmm. So reading, mm-hmm, people like Richard Wagamese mm-hmm, and Lee Miracle and Louise Erdrich, was, yeah, flipped something in my head. And I was like, wow, this is something I really want to do.
Yes.
You know, I want to write about, you know, who we are, what our unique experiences can be, and just, you know, compelling stories in literature. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was about when I was 16, 17, where, mm-hmm, I really decided I wanted to try it.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating, I find, to read multiple, not to take anything away from some of the literary, you know, people of European background, all that, mm-hmm, kind of stuff, but it's fascinating to see something through a bit of a different lens, mm-hmm, through a bit of a different focus. I remember, and to try to describe that, I remember my wife and I enjoy photography, mm-hmm, and we both took a picture of the same thing, and I saw where she was taking the picture from. Mm-hmm. And I went over and I framed it like she was framing. I go, oh, cool. Like, this is how you see things,
mm-hmm,
right? And it just offers you that window into a deeper wisdom, just a more fulfilling way to be and to live your life day to day.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's really important. I find it interesting that in our school system, especially in a place like Parry Sound, where there's a large Indigenous population, that there's no books by Indigenous authors.
Back in the 90s, yeah. I know, like,
there probably is now.
Oh, yeah. Like Moon of the Crest of Snow is studied in high school now, which is like one of the greatest honors of my life, cool. For sure.
Yeah. Right on. I'm glad that it's changed, because I remember even me being in like grade 6 and learning about the different geographical regions of Canada, and all of them were presented in what we can extract from these areas.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this area is great for mining, like the Canadian Shield, the mining and the gold and the and all these things, and each one. And then I remember him covering the James Bay Lowlands, right? Uh-huh. And he's like, this area, we haven't figured out what, like, pretty much just poo-pooed it. Right. And this is what we're like, what can we rape and pillage from these areas? That was a,
that's
don't
wild.
Even bother this place. And I just remember thinking, well, it's actually the second largest, me just being like, you know, who I am in grade six, already knew all this stuff, right? Yeah. It's being like, well, it's actually the second largest wetland in the world, one of the highest population densities of moose in the world. There's a thriving and fascinating Cree culture with at least 3 distinct dialects in there. And here it is, like, this is a kind of a boring area. Let's move on. Yeah, exactly. So it's good to hear that that some sort of changes are happening, and maybe with some of that history, it's better told. Like, you talk about residential schools, for example. Didn't learn a thing about it in school, right?
Yeah,
and I feel like, maybe, I don't think it came from a well-meaning place, but sometimes maybe people think, well, if we don't talk about it, it will just go away. But if we don't understand history, we don't understand why things are the way they are now. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I think teaching that to kids so they can understand what's going on around them will make a difference on how they choose to, handle what they do day to day, and then for the future. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I totally agree with you. For so long it was outliers like you who knew the truth and who knew the values in all different kinds of perspectives, right? And you teaching your own teacher about that, right?
Yeah, like, right.
It's amazing. But like, there's,
I'm just like,
yeah,
hand up. He's like, oh no.
Yeah.
What's Jim Baird gonna say?
But it's like, as mentioned, people who are on the margins or on the peripheries who are doing that, no matter what their background are. And really, like, the Canadian story has been one of mythology for so long, right? That people have really been propagandized to learn, of this kind, benevolent place that doesn't have a history of slavery like the U.S. and, is friendly and, good to their neighbors, et cetera, right? But that's not really the truth. And fortunately now, thanks to the work of, like, grassroots people and more formalized initiatives like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like, kids are growing up today knowing what the real history is, and as a dad with, 3 Anishinaabe kids going through the public system, it's great. It's comforting to know that the truth is being offered to them now, and that, they won't have to be the outliers speaking up for their people or themselves or whatever else, right? So there has been a major shift for sure. Yeah. It makes me hopeful for the future, definitely.
Yeah, and do you think that's going to hopefully lead to some more people, Indigenous authors, more people, doing what you do and kind of getting their voice out there, writing on, a variety of different topics, whether it's, traditional related topics or whether it's just other interesting facts or fiction? You think that's going to sort of broaden that spectrum of people?
I hope so. Yeah. And when you think about how the trend is going upward, it's a result of, like, trailblazing people, a couple of generations ago, who really kicked open doors for us, who really advocated for our truths and our communities and our stories so that we could express ourselves more freely today. I think of people like Lee Miracle or Richard Wagamese, who were some of those trailblazing people in the 80s and 90s, from a literary perspective, right? But also, if you think about all the other arts, you know, the Junos were just this past weekend. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Ace Inabi, you know, OG Cree guy winning some major mm-hmm. awards. William Prince, Anishinaabe guy from Manitoba.
Was Midnight Shine there this year?
I don't think they were there, no. Yeah. But yeah, they're awesome too.
Yeah, I talk with Adrian.
Adrian's awesome, eh? Yeah, such a great dude. But like those, also on the show was like this tribute to Robbie Robertson of the mm-hmm. band, you know, who passed recently. Mm-hmm. And he was like one of just like a few people back in the 60s who was, you know, being a proud advocate for Indigenous, you know, arts and identity and so on, right?
Yeah.
So it's cool to see like this big showcase of Indigenous artists musically who, you know, are carrying on this traditions and spirit of someone like him. You know? So
that's great. That's awesome. Uh-huh. Yeah, it must be still hard, right, to just put pen to paper though.
Oh yeah.
You know? Like, have you ever gotten writer's block and been like delete, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like this, like when you're faced with an entire novel. So I'm also a writer, but I write magazine articles. Yeah. And they can even be challenging to structure. You know, are you ever sort of faced with a mountain to climb before you just sit down and type the first paragraph of a full novel?
Oh man, it's every day. You know, those first sentences are the hardest to write for sure. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, this is where it begins. You know, this is where we're, you know, leading a reader onto a journey. And the writer's block comes up almost every day.
Really?
Oh yeah. Almost every day. Yeah. And it just, it comes to a point where it's like, okay, you know, it's not coming. You know, I have these images, these ideas in my head, and I'm just not able to put them into words at this point. Mm-hmm. So before I get frustrated or angry, I stop. You know, I'll close the laptop, I'll go outside for a walk, or
go put some death chokes on people in jiu-jitsu. Exactly. Clear your mind a little bit, you know.
Yeah, that's exactly part of it too. Yeah. So yeah, stepping away and then coming back always works.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I pick it right up from there.
I find that works for me too, actually, because, you know, as much as I'm getting to do all these outdoor adventures with my job, I get kind of bogged down with all the like details and minutia, and I'm thinking about too many things at once, you know. And then I'll go on, do one of my trips, and I'll get back and I'll totally feel ready to tackle everything all over again. Nice. You know, or just even a shorter little break, just you know, getting off like that. So yeah, I think that's an important good tip to anybody that's trying to really do anything creative, whether it's writing a book professionally or just editing maybe their first YouTube video.
Yeah.
If they want to try that out too. So,
yeah. Another thing I find really helpful too is when it's all these things in your head, as you're saying, like all this massive experience, and you're like, oh, what am I going to do with all of it? You know, I find focusing it here and there really helps for me. If I'm like, okay, what do I want the reader to get out of this? Or what's the key message? Or what do I want the reader to feel when they're done reading this book or something like that? So just like boiling it down to those really basic things really helps for me too.
Yeah, cool. So so we talked about Wasoxing a little bit before. How did people, which is kind of your roots and the basis of where you kind of learned all the things that you now use in your books and in your arsenal for writing. How did people come to be Wasoxing? Wasoxing is a reserve, right?
Yeah.
So what was it when people, how did they, I guess, come to be there and sort of settle there permanently?
Well, Wasoxing was always a revered place for Anishinaabe. The main points of settlement for Anishinaabe people on the north shore of Lake Huron and Georgian Bay is just all up and down the shoreline, right? So you'd have like quasi-permanent settlements here and there, and people would move back and forth, or, you know, among a few, according to the season, according to the food, right? So historically, one of the settlements for the Anishinaabeg of Wasoxing was at the mouth of the Seguin River, which is now the town of Parry Sound.
Right. Yeah.
At the mouth of the river, there was one of the places that they always went to for a long time. And the island Wasoxing itself, you know, there are some sacred sites there. And people who were traveling anywhere among the landscape, would always stop there to pay homage at these different sacred sites. It's a huge island, but people still knew of these places, right, from far and wide. There was always, action happening on the island, but it wasn't usually like a permanent place to settle or to live, because it's an island, right, and you can't move too much. It's a huge island, but there isn't much in terms of like variety in the landscape. It's mostly swamp on the actual island itself. Mm-hmm. So this settlement at the mouth of the Sugun River, you know, had been there for as long as anybody remembered. But after the Robinson-Huron Treaty was signed in 1850, it sort of dictated these other potential places for the Anishinaabe to go. And then once Canada was confederated in 1867, and then the Department of Indian Affairs was created, it was interpreted that, you know, the people who lived there would have to go out onto the island, onto Parry Island or Wasauksing. And then, you know, at the mouth of the Sugun River is where Parry Sound came to be.
So obviously. Was Parry Sound even there at the time?
It was there, yeah. So Parry Sound, I think, was incorporated in the 1860s at some point, right? Like, I can't remember if it was right before or right after Confederation, or it could have been in the 1870s, I'm not sure. But there were settlers there for sure, right?
Yeah.
But then once Canada was, you know, certified or confederated or became a country, and, you know, the Indians had to be dealt with, how Canada dealt with, you know, the people I'm descended
from. What do you mean dealt with?
Just moved off of the land, moved off the desirable land, basically, right?
Moved off of the so for what? For why did they want them off the desirable
land? Well, I think forestry was the main industry around Parry Sound, and at the mouth of the Sugun River is what's now the Parry Sound Harbor. So that's where
they ran the logs down the river.
Yeah. So the logs would all be, gathered in that harbor there in the sound, and then moved out to Georgian Bay, Lake Huron, wherever else, right?
To a rail line, maybe?
Yeah, to a rail line or to other, you know, ships or whatever else. So that's how the people of Wasauksing came to be there permanently. So it was traumatic. My grandmother told me it was her grandparents' generation who were first displaced from the mainland out into the island. And then she said her grandmother would tell her stories about sitting on the shore of the island and looking back to the town and seeing all the trees get cut down. And and that was their homeland, right, for forever. And they couldn't return to it because you needed permission from the Indian agent to leave the reserve, right? So it was an apocalyptic moment, you know?
Which is sort of like, you mentioned that in your book. I forget who it was, but she was talking about how they'd already been through
an
apocalypse.
Exactly.
And how what was happening now with the power going out and all the unknowns, how she wasn't so scared of it.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah. And that moment in the book is really an homage to that conversation I had with my grandmother. Because it was funny, about a year after the blackout of 2003, I was back home in Wasauksing visiting with her. And we're watching TV and there's all this like anniversary coverage coming up, you know, a year since the blackout. What were you doing then and all
right? Right.
And so I said to her, I was like, yeah, Graham, that was wild, eh? You know, me and my brothers there thought it was the end of the world. And she's just kind of like, oh, end of the world. And then she's like, well, remember about your own history, right? And she started telling me about, you know, what her grandmother would tell her when she was a little girl, you know? Yeah. So that's how people came permanently to Wasauksing. Yeah. I mean, like it's our home still, you know. Like I love it there. It's a beautiful place. You've been there, but historically we weren't confined to a place, right?
Right.
But you know, at the same time, you make the most of it, and I think there's a strong reverence for the land still, and our way of life there that we have.
Well, just look at how beautiful Parry Island still is.
Yeah,
I think that's a tribute to the people that live there.
And I think, you know, there's a general consensus that we want to keep it that way, you know. There are, of course, all kinds of different development influences that any community could come up against nowadays, right? But I think, we generally, not speaking for everybody, but I think we generally would like to keep it as it is.
Without any major kind of developments.
Yeah.
No, huge hotels. That
no,
kind of,
yeah,
that
no
kind
huge
of
resorts. Yeah.
Yeah. It's it's a pretty special place actually. Mm-hmm. And then it is also pretty close to Parry Sound too. So you can
10-minute drive.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's pretty neat. Yeah. No, just thinking back, I think, what people maybe don't understand too is that is kind of the sacredness of the land and the forest, how that was sort of like, you know, what a lot of people sort of church would be now. If you, if you're a lot of people that, you know, practice Christianity, their church, you know, is the sacred place. You know, for somebody like your grandmother, looking back at where they used to live and where they grew up and seeing the trees and everything being destroyed and all this injury, it's like a freak, it's like a worse nightmare. It's it's like a church being ripped down like that. I always had dreams when I was a kid of you know, where my family's camp was, this water access. I always had these reoccurring dreams that development was encroaching and they're building like an apartment building at the end of the bay, or I walk back into the bush and I saw bulldozers coming in. And so I started telling my mom and my mother, like, we have those dreams too. And the whole family has these dreams that, you know, stuff is encroaching on the area. But, you know, I at least we do have some pretty, considering that we're, you know, 3 hours from Sudbury, three and a half hours from Toronto, 3.5 hours from Sudbury, somewhere around there, North Bay, that we still in the area have a pretty good amount of like undeveloped. Area and territory, right? Like even my river here, the Magnetowan River, you can go from Wawakesh to they call it Wawakesh, it's really Wawashkesh, but a lot of people just call it Wawakesh now. But you know, it to Bing Inlet, and you know, you'll see some quad trails and stuff going into it, but there's really not that much development in there still. And even behind me is like a large area where there's no roads. I think one of the largest areas in central Ontario, and a lot of that too, you wouldn't know it to look at it, but you look at an area on the on like, you know, the MNR map, and it's put a special interest crown land. I don't know how but you feel about the term crown land, but anyways, but apparently it's got it exhibits an Atlantic coastal plain flora. So essentially that means that for whatever reason, the plants and trees and certain things that grow here don't grow anywhere else in Ontario. And the only other place they grow in Canada is on the East Coast. And so this is something that, in listening to you and listen and talking about, you know, the medicines and stuff like that that were on Parry Island and in the area, I wonder if that is something, you know, that the indigenous people of this area already kind of knew and could get sort of different medicines that they couldn't really get in a larger area. And I think that's one of the reasons that they haven't developed it. Is it because it's an Atlantic coastal plain flora?
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I just kind of came up with that now after listening to you.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have that medicinal expertise, but I know of it and I was raised with it. But when you talk about sacred spaces, like before, like a swamp is sacred, you know, because of all the medicine that's in there. You know, a medicinal, I think, leader or harvester would walk into a swamp and like fill all kinds of different pockets with everything that they would see in there, because of, you know, how valuable an ecosystem like that is medicinally, right? So yeah, it's knowledge like that. But that is, you know, fortunately making a big comeback, mostly because of the resolve of the younger generation to know these things. Like you see a lot of young people nowadays spending time with elders or knowledge keepers and going out into the bush to make sure that they know that, you know, to ensure that, you know, there's that advocacy for conservation too. That's not just indigenous oriented, but that can be shared with everybody else so that people know the value of those very specific, unique places, you know, and what they can offer all of us as humans. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if, the whole thing with shows on TV and like, cause like, let's be honest, when you're a teenager, you know, you want to do what's cool.
Yeah.
You know, and if it's, is it cool to go camping and survival and kind of stuff like that? I kind of feel like it's getting there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it might draw some more people to that, or to, you know, indigenous people to more cultural activities because all, you know, all those survival shows and all those survival skills, sure, you know, there's everybody from, you know, different parts of the world, ancestors had to live like that. But a lot of those things are indigenous Canadian skills, right? Like even just the canoe I paddle.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Europeans didn't freaking, my ancestors when they came over here, whatever, I think a couple hundred years ago or whatever, they didn't freaking bring a canoe over here. Like that, right? Like that was something that was kind of invented here and now is such a mainstream thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if a lot of people realize, you know, how connected that is. Mm-hmm. And I think with the swamps, like you're saying, it's one of the only areas that gets all that light.
Yeah.
And there's that rich soil. I remember getting giardia. Beaver fever.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds all cute, eh? Like, yeah. Beaver fever. I remember the first, oh, I have beaver fever. And I'm like, I want to die. I'm so sick, yeah. Right? And I got these new water tabs. And I'm traveling through this swamp, which on my map was supposed to be a big beaver pond. And I'm like, the dam was blowing out. And so I'm just like freaking dying, like miserable. I have giardia because I got these new water tabs and I'm like using them. And then basically I'm traveling up towards Moosonee and everything's so swampy there. Yeah. And then I read the water tab. It's like, let's sit for 4 hours. I'm like, oh man, I thought it was half an hour because my old ones were half an hour. So here I'm just drinking for like days, just swamp water. And then I get this horrible thing. And luckily it turned out to be a blessing in disguise that this dam was blown because there's all this wild mint along the way. And I could actually smell it before I saw it.
Huh.
And so wild mint is good at treating, you know, like a modern, you know, naturopath will say, oh, it quells the symptoms of giardia or beaver fever, which I would do. So I'd eat a whole bunch and then 20 minutes later, the symptoms come back. Then I'd eat a whole bunch and then they would come back. But I never actually fully got giardia. And nice. So I have a Ojibwe friend, Alex Mathias, who actually told me before that it's further than just, you know, helping the symptoms, that it actually cures it. And he told me a story that it did as well.
No way.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I'm traveling through a swamp and here I am, you know, medicating myself with something that works extremely well as I'm traveling. It's just kind of
amazing.
I did the trick. And of course, you know, I was lucky, but that I knew that one little tip.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, somebody that really knows what they're doing probably would know there's a whole lot more different plants and medicinal things in that area. It's an in-depth thing to learn, but it's really interesting.
But as you're saying, it's cool now.
Yeah.
And it's not just for the sake of like novelty or gimmickry or anything like that. Yeah. This is like essential knowledge that all people could use, right?
Yeah.
When I was a teenager, like, you know, it wasn't valued by mainstream at all. And that's why I was like, oh, I got to leave the res. I got to go to the city.
Right.
You know, that's I got to leave this world behind. You could have
just stayed there and been a YouTuber.
I could have, yeah, eventually.
Yeah, that's awesome. Anyways, I find all that kind of stuff fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't know if as many people do, but, you know, like the survival shows on YouTube, it's getting big. I have a pretty good YouTube following, and I cover some of that stuff. And hopefully it all transfers over to just more people caring about nature.
100%. I totally agree with you. Hopefully. You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Right on. Okay, well, you know what? We've been chatting for a while. This has been a good conversation.
Oh, man, this has been so fun, Jim. Yeah. Like, holy geez. Yeah, absolutely. We covered a lot. Holy.
We did. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure we could go cover more, but I just, you know, I want, before we end, I really would like to know if there's anything, let's say there's a new writer that's emerging, you know, somebody younger that wants to get into it, maybe an indigenous writer that wants to look for an outlet that's going to be that catalyst to help them potentially get to a place like you have gotten to.
Mm-hmm.
What advice could you share with somebody else who's trying to get there?
Oh, great question. I would say, you know, write as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Be proud of your experiences. Tap into your genuine self and express yourself freely, essentially, you know, because there's huge value in the story you have to tell, no matter who you are or no matter where you're from. And everyone's story is different. So you may think, oh, why would anybody want to hear from me? I'm XYZ, right? But at the same time, there are different ways that we can put different kinds of spins on stories and really authenticate who we are as people, especially as Indigenous people. So there's a greater, I think, appetite by everyone, indigenous and non-indigenous alike, to learn from us, to read our stories, to watch our films, watch our plays, listen to our music, look at our art, and so on, right? And it's only growing exponentially, in my opinion. And everybody's experience is valid and needed on that sort of spectrum of experiences. So in terms of writing, I would just say write it down is the biggest first step. Mm-hmm. Write the story you want to write and share it with others. That's the biggest second step too, because that takes a lot of confidence. It takes a lot of, I think foresight into knowing that you're, you know, trying to get something out there. And most importantly, you'll get feedback by sharing it with other people, you know? Mm-hmm. So write it down and share it with others. And then from there, I think it really snowballs into, you know, you understanding how you want to be a writer, what you want your voice to be, and the audience you want to reach. Mm-hmm. But that sort of comes secondarily by being true to yourself and true to the story that you want to tell, you know? And there are a lot of great initiatives out there, a lot of great mentorships. I'm part of what's called the Audible Indigenous Writers Circle, which is running for the rest of the year. We're looking for aspiring Indigenous writers to come on board and learn from mentors. So look up different mentorship programs. That's what I'd suggest.
Mm-hmm. And Moon of the Turning Leaves is on audiobook as well, is it not?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That guy that you got to do it is great.
Oh, he's amazing. Yeah. Billy Morasti. He did Moon of the Crescent Snow as well.
Yes.
And he just, breathes a whole new life into the story that I just feel so fortunate and privileged to have him do that, you know?
And I found too, because I listened to, I think, the last third of the book, he was really good at kind of using almost a different voice for the different characters, which kind of brought them to life a little bit too.
Yeah. Well, he's total pro, a pro actor, right?
Yeah.
So he does that expertly.
Cool. Well, Wob, thanks a lot, man. Thanks for coming to the
Jim,
show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to have you. Such a delight, such an honor. Thank you. Miigwech.
You're welcome. Miigwech.
Okay. Thanks for watching another episode of Baird Country. And don't forget to check out Fishing Clash. Fun little fishing video game you can download right onto your phone. Have a good one.